Hey everybody, it's Sadie from the Daily Escape Podcast. How are you guys doing? So we want to share with you a wonderful surprise podcast that we did with a couple of family members of ours. And it's actually my brother-in-law and sister-in-law. It is their adoption, infertility, rediscovering their faith in God story. And so we've broken it up into two parts because we're all talkers, and we got together one weekend when we were down in Missouri, and it actually ended up being, I think, like 2.5 hours long. So we did split it up a little bit, but I want to ask a couple questions just to kind of lead you in here. So what do you do when your dreams of starting a family don't go as planned? Hold on tightly and walk in faith. That's what you do. So listen as Stephen St. Clair and I interview my brother and sister-in-law regarding their journey of love, disappointment, loss, and learning to listen to God's direction in your life and just basically hold on tight and walk in faith. Stay tuned for part one next.
Hi everybody, this is Stephen St. Clair with the Crafted Quill Podcast.
Sadie K. Frazier from the Daily Escape Podcast.
And we are doing something a little different. We're not even home.
We are not. Where are we?
Missouri. No, in all seriousness, we, as we try to look for different ideas and things to talk about, I realized one day, I was like, you know what? We're going down to see my brother and sister-in-law. And there's a story to be told.
Yep. You've been wanting to talk to them for a while and have them on.
A little bit. So, welcome, listeners, to our show, that new and old. My brother Paul and his wife, Christina.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Thanks for being here. So, the reason why we're having you on the show is this is probably going to be point blank, but a very family-oriented show. And in saying that, let's talk about your family. You guys met in high school, correct?
Yeah, we want to hear your story.
How far back do you want to go? Blow the dust off the covers.
Well, we started going to school together in the 8th grade.
Yep.
But we didn't officially start dating till the end of the last day of high school, our senior year.
Right.
that's a long time to go without the yes part or no part.
Yeah, I had to wait 2 years for him.
Yeah, we didn't.
You had a cutoff date, though, if I remember right.
I did.
Right. Like, if he doesn't ask me out by this day.
Really? Mm-hmm. Did he know the cutoff?
No. I didn't talk to him.
You were
lucky.
Well,
we liked each other in high school. I think it started around the 10th grade when we, you know, we could tell we liked each other, but I had no intentions of dating in high school. You know, when you're...
Well, I didn't live at home, so it's not like I was going to listen to the phone conversation and giggle.
It was more of, you know, I looked around and saw my friends, and they would date, and then they would break up, mm-hmm. and they would hate each other,
mm-hmm.
and it would split
the
people
drama.
Up, and I didn't want the drama. I worked a lot when I was in high school, and I liked my weekends of going out with friends and the freedoms with that, you know, those kind of things. So when I just kind of made a rule that I wasn't going to date in high school with myself, and I stuck to it. So
you almost lost out.
So I waited till the last day of high school
was over.
I had written a note probably, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks before the end of school, and I'd had that thing in my pocket.
Check yes or no kind of thing?
Kind of. Well, I was kind of pretty bold in my letter, but I was bold in writing, but I wasn't bold in giving it to her. Because I'm trying to remember. I think I had that letter in my pocket so long that I ended up having to rewrite it because he kind of got all messed up in my pocket. So I think I rewrote it.
And you know what? Speaking of that, I think I remember you met me at church at the Gathering Center, and you showed me a picture of Christina, and your hands were shaking a little bit, and I'm like, you didn't say anything. I'm like, is she your girlfriend? And I'm like, yeah, I just asked her out. I'm like, well, better late than never.
Yeah, I was really secretive about my.
I don't blame him.
Were you surprised?
Stuff. Yeah, because I thought you liked me too for 2 years,
mm-hmm. And
I was praying about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I told God, look, if you know if it's okay for us to date, then I'd like Paul to make a move before school gets out. And it was the last day of school,
mm-hmm.
And I was trying to put myself out there a little bit more with flirting because he was reciprocal with flirting.
Yep.
So I thought he liked me. And about lunchtime, I was like, okay, I guess the answer is no. So I started to back off.
Well, we went to a movie the last day of school.
The class did, yeah.
Our class did it.
Mm-hmm.
So what was that stupid movie? It was one of those...
Twister? Was it?
No, it was one where the comet hits the Earth and...
Oh,
Bruce Willis.
No, it was the other one.
Is it?
I can't remember.
We'll Google it.
Anyway, so we watched that movie. She actually sat next to me in the theater, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so after the movie was over, we were all going our separate ways. And so we were out in the parking lot. She'd already kind of walked to her car.
I was in my car.
Pardon me. Mm-hmm. I was scoping out where she was at. And finally got up the gumption to go up to her car. She rolled down the window. I handed her the note, and I walked away.
I was already in reverse. I had parked next to him to give him, you know, a very last shot. Maybe I'd talk to him after school. And, I was ready to be done. I was like, okay, the answer is no. I thought I had my answer. So I was in reverse, turned around to leave the parking lot, and mm-hmm. turned back to check the front again, and he was there with a note,
boop,
slipping it in the door.
So, Christina, would you say you were more on the traditional side of the guy doing the work and you being the lady in waiting for your knight?
Absolutely. I wanted to be wanted.
Yep.
That's a good way to look at that. Okay, so let's flash forward. You guys went to college together. You were more college sweethearts by now, right?
Yeah, we went to University of Central Missouri now, but
CMSU.
Central Missouri State University back when we were going there at the time. Mm-hmm. So we had our freshman year there. So we ate all our meals together, you know, all those kind of things. So we got to know each other really well, really fast.
Yeah. But we didn't even know that we were both going to school there until we dated for like a month. I didn't even know where he was going to school, yeah.
Huh?
It just worked out that way. Mm-hmm. So.
And then when you found out where each other was going, did that change the scope of things? For better, for worse?
For better, because I remember asking him, what do you think you're going to do at the end of summer? Like, where are you going to college? Do you want to continue this once we get to college? Is this just for the summer? What are you thinking? And, you know, so where are you going to school? I'm going to CMSU. He's like, oh, I'm going there too. So, yeah, I'd like to continue.
Heart leap through your chest
for
a brief moment.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Okay, so yes. Flash forward even farther. How long were you guys dating before marriage came up? And then when did you make plans?
We dated for a full year. So we started dating right after high school, so May. So it was right after the May the next year, after our first freshman year of college, is when I proposed. So.
Mm-hmm. And then how long after that until you guys got married?
Another year. So, a year of engagement, mm-hmm. which I would never recommend.
I think time probably seems
way too long.
Yeah.
So, at what point, and this leads into the meat of the story, the conversation about kids. When did that happen? And what was that conversation like, if you remember?
Well, I think every couple has the conversation of, do you want kids? How many kids do you want? you know, your dreams, all those kind of things. And of course, I'm the, I just want two kids, you know. And Chris, she's, I don't remember. That
right from what was your secret number?
My number was 5. 3 or 5.
And I was like,
not two, cool. Wasn't enough.
And I was like, no, sir.
That was a weird number to me. So, yeah, 3 or 5.
See how that worked out?
I see
that. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Kind of funny.
Yeah, we both have 5 kids.
Oh, wait, shh, don't tell that part.
Drop the mic. No, in all seriousness, no. So you guys have been married, and when, now, how can I say this? Obviously, there was trying for children at some point. When in your child procreation did things like, okay, things should start happening by now, and then you follow me, so mm-hmm. you're on top of the mountain, like, yeah, we got this, and then somewhere along the line, it's like, something's not right. We should be doing something by now.
Let's say 3 years into it.
It was 2 years.
2 to 3.
I remember it was 2 years. And it wasn't like, we should be doing something about it by now. It was like, let's see what's going on.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. we'd been trying, and
yeah.
Well,
nothing, you know.
We hadn't been not trying. It's really, you know, and when everybody around you is getting pregnant, it's like, what is going on?
Yeah.
What's happening here?
Yeah.
Did that's both true. Of you go get looked at, or?
Yeah, we both got tested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it, what ended up being the diagnosis, if you could, or you can shorten it?
I have polycystic ovarian syndrome, and I think we knew that before Paul got tested.
Yeah.
Because they said, this could make it more difficult for you to have kids, and that's all they said the first mm-hmm. time. They didn't go into what it was or anything like that. So then after 2 years of nothing happening, then I was like, let's go find out what this mm-hmm. is.
And I don't think they knew back then all the details they do now and treatments so. And things like that. It was just yeah. first talked about.
It felt not sketchy, but it was like, I don't know. It seemed like there was a lot of unknowns.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you go to a doctor's visit and not be able to get the answers you want mm-hmm. and those kind of things.
It sounds like they're avoiding what should have been told from the get-go and keeping things kind of on the shady side.
I think because I was so young, they felt like they didn't have to tell me, maybe, because I was 19, even before I had my first exam, just like before we got married, and you know, they ask you questions about your cycle and stuff, and I mentioned that it was irregular, and they're like, oh, okay, well, that might make it more difficult for you. And that's what they said. They didn't say more difficult to have children. So I didn't even know what that meant. I didn't ask, because as long as everything came back normal, I didn't really care.
Yep.
Did they recommend, once the path had been set, was there any kind of treatment, or was there, what options did you have at that point?
They gave us fertility treatments, in which, I don't even remember what it was called, but we had treatments done were
we went through multiple different kinds of treatments.
Yeah, there was the medication,
there's just medication to try to regulate some, I don't think they even said hormones at the time, it was like to regulate my, I can't even remember what it was, sorry, so just for me, and then like injections eventually, and then some other stuff, and then we decided not to go any further because it was going to be so expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get to a point where it's like you're either invested or you find an alternative, mm-hmm. because it gets where, you know, treatments were like $10,000 or
no
more,
guarantee.
And then you know, so you get to a point where it's like, all right, we're either going to invest in this that's no guarantee, or we need to find another alternative where there is a guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the difficult part. And through all this, month by month, you're going through this emotional roller coaster of, did it work this time? okay, now we're broke again. Now we have to save up again for the next mm-hmm. treatment. You know, how many times are we going to go through this? How many times are you going to go through another cycle that didn't work? And then the emotional crash each time that stuff happens. And it's draining on you, as your relationship, mm-hmm. the whole thing. I mean, it's brutal.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. Cost-wise, without really giving away dollars and cents, you mentioned $10,000. That was roughly like one shot, and then it didn't work, and you went back and tried it again, or were you one and done?
When you start getting into like where they harvest eggs and they mm-hmm. fertilize them and then they put them back, you know, mm-hmm. that's when you're talking about big bucks.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of where we were heading. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and like, you know, we had to really step back and go, okay, what are we doing here? Right. You know, what's our goals? You know, those kind of things.
I do want to say, and I don't know if this is appropriate, but it's still like a sore spot for me. As you said, what did it cost? It cost me my job.
It did.
Because I told my employer, I'm gonna be honest with you, I'm gonna be gone, I'm gonna be asking for one day a month for fertility treatments.
Mm-hmm.
And I kid you not, it was less than 2 weeks later and I'm doing air quotes here, laid off.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I know they talked to other people about it.
Pathetic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because people had said, yeah, so-and-so told me that you guys were trying to have a baby. So there was no integrity mm-hmm. at all from my employer on it.
Really, the cost was higher
than the actual money.
Yeah, you can't put a price tag on that, really.
No.
So,
and a lot of couples don't make it through even that process because it does affect your marriage too. Yeah. So
it starts stuff taking apart.
The treatments and stuff we were going through were probably like $2,000 to $3,000 a session. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we were doing.
Yeah.
And so we were still a young couple at the time, you know. We were in our early 20s mm-hmm. still. And
full of like, vim and vigor still.
We're like, you know, we don't have that kind of money just laying around.
Yeah.
You know, so we had to save up and, okay, we can afford it now again. And so you can only do that so many times, mm-hmm. you know.
Especially after you lose a job.
Yeah,
that's right. Then you're down to one income and still trying to.
Especially when you get laid off. So.
So treatments weren't taking. Hopes and prayers weren't really working. At some point, though, another decision was made, i.e. adoption. When did that come up as a serious option, and what was that conversation like?
Well...
And then when did you start telling people that's where you were going?
We had talked before we got married about how many kids each of us wanted, and would you be open to adoption or not? I always felt open to adoption. Paul said he was open to it. We never said before or after we have biological children. We were just both open to it. So even before mm-hmm. we got married, we knew we were open to it. We didn't know anybody who'd adopted. I really didn't have anybody in my circle mm-hmm. that I could ask about it or mm-hmm. family. But I'd say after I lost my job, it was really like, okay, we need something that's going to be guaranteed. Let's look at what the cost of adoption is and how long does it take? What are the instances? You know, what percentage of people come home with children? Mm-hmm. And it's almost guaranteed. We learned, you know, as long as you do all your paperwork.
Because the way you went, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the conversation we had earlier when you were talking about domestic, as far as you want to kind of explain that.
We did a lot of research whether we wanted to do domestic or international, or mm-hmm. you know, we looked into fostering, you know, all those kind of options of what's available, and we were looking for, you know, we've already been on an emotional roller coaster, you know, mm-hmm. at that point. We were looking for, okay, what's the most guaranteed route mm-hmm. to get through this. And so after looking at it all, really, I don't know if it's still the same today or not. I'm guessing it is. Domestic adoption is just a mess. It's not guaranteed. There's a lot of fraud. There's not really any closed adoptions anymore mm-hmm. domestically. So
say what a closed adoption is.
A closed adoption is when the biological mother doesn't know who's getting the child.
Right. All the biological family. It's sealed.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. a sealed kind of a deal.
So they can't show up at your door and say, hey,
right,
things have changed. See, I would like my child back.
Yeah. Pardon me. So, and some people are okay with that. And mm-hmm. I have a friend who is there. They have a good relationship with a biological mother, mm-hmm. you know, and it works out that way. But mm-hmm. you know what? A lot of other people, it doesn't work out that way.
That's right.
And for us, it was more of the, we're a young couple, and we're like, we don't want 3 years from now the knock yeah. at the door,
yeah.
you know, and then all of a sudden, I want my child back, you know, and then you're in legal mm-hmm. battles and everything else after you've already invested all of that money mm-hmm. and our,
and
you
love
know, and your heart is yeah. in that yeah. child as your own, you know, and all those things. So yeah, I mean, all of that comes into play. So
you guys are now, you've made the decision, physical childbirth is not on the table at this point. You settled on adoption. Did you have out-of-country options, or was it this country, or Europe, or did you have options?
Well, I want to, but you said settled on adoption, and that's fine. We didn't settle for adoption. I want that to be clear. These children are not second best, and I don't think at all that's what you're hinting. But
no,
for people
sorry.
Who may have misunderstood that, this is not a second best option for us. This is a different option.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, but yes, we did have lots of country options. When we started calling around different adoption agencies, we found out there were lots and lots of, well, 10 or 12 countries
mm-hmm.
that would work with the United States in adoptions.
How did they advertise the different countries? Did they give you a book with different
You had to basically pick adoption, different adoption agencies
mm-hmm.
worked with different countries. And so you'd have to kind of go through whatever, you know, we looked at several different adoption agencies, and you kind of have to look at their record and the countries. Mm-hmm. You have to kind of do your own research, because some countries, you know, there's, you know, you've heard there's some stuff, fraud and stuff that even goes on internationally.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we wanted straightforward, clear-cut, no shady business, you know, where is that?
Mm-hmm.
And so we picked an adoption agency who we thought had a really upstanding reputation. They were local. They had local meetings that we could go to monthly, and they offered classes we could meet. We, you know, once you picked a country, which we did, the country, they represent the adoption agency we used had 3 or 4 or 5 countries they represented.
They had lots of countries.
It was mm-hmm. China, Russia, Kazakhstan. They had, I don't know if it was Ethiopia or...
Not yet. They did eventually.
Yeah, and Colombia. So there was lots of... So we'd go on these meetings, and when we first started, there was probably 50 to 100 people in these meetings.
I think more than 100, yeah.
And then they would talk just generally, or they mm-hmm. would have some basic classes for people for understanding adoption and child behavior, all those kind mm-hmm. of things.
So you really had to learn what all you're up against, basically.
Well, that was one thing we loved about the agency, was they provided so much education
That's
as part
good.
Of the package.
Yeah.
You know, and then we were able to meet in our country groups, and we were able to talk about specific issues with that country,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then people were coming back with their children. They'd bring them to the meetings and were able to
Would
see
help.
The children
mm-hmm.
and they would talk about their experiences in the country.
Anything scary?
And, I mean, adoption itself can...
or like from other people's stories.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it was just more motivating than anything, because
mm-hmm.
you come back
That's
and
good.
You see these beautiful children that,
mm-hmm.
you know, were just abandoned, and it's crazy, you know. And but you know, like Colombia, which is the country we settled on, you know, they have sibling groups. I mean, they were more known for having sibling
yeah.
groups
mm-hmm.
and things like that. So we'd see families come back with 3, 4, 5 children at a time,
and that was common.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
and it was
rare to see
and,
one child.
You know, when we were going
yeah.
through this, we started off. We just want a baby, 2 and
That's
2 years
That's what I was
going to
say. Did you expect that then?
No, we were on the baby list. We're like, there's no way I'm going to mm-hmm. go into
right.
this adopting more than just a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got on the baby list, which at the time when we first started, it was supposed to be like
12 to 18
mm-hmm. months is what they told us. Yeah. And, you know, they're just guessing. They do the best they can, but it's really up to the country to decide who win their selection. It's not the adoption agency.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of help facilitate that. And so, you know, it was 2005 when we were able to, we had to wait till your, that was one thing that helped us determine what country we picked was your age. So like China, you had to be
30, I think.
Over 30 years old, you know, and at the time we're 23 years old, you know.
Yeah.
And so we had to wait for Christina to turn 25 even to even adopt from Colombia.
To even apply.
So in 2000, and that was one of the reasons why we chose Colombia too, is because we were able to do it at a younger age than even some of the other countries. And so, and we liked their process, you know, and we knew it was a the reputation of the how the children's agencies within Colombia were really upstanding. They had great policies in place to make sure the children were healthy, you know, all those things. So nothing illegal, all those kind of things were
in place. Did they run a background check on you guys and how extensive was that?
Yeah.
It takes, what, a year? To go through
it
everything?
It took at least 6 months to put our dossier together.
It's a mountain
and
of paperwork.
And they checked everything.
When you weren't old enough yet, quite anyways, right?
Well, we applied through the agency.
Yeah, you can't.
And then once I was 25, we started working on the
dossier. You can't start filling out the paperwork. The dossier, which is kind of the book of all your paperwork you have to fill out. You have to go to psychologists. You got to have people come in your home and interview you. You have to write papers, you've got immigration paperwork, you've got visas, you've got, I don't even remember everything.
Medical exams.
Medical exams, they want to know, you are an open book. I mean, you have to go in knowing they're going to do FBI checks, they're checking everything they can possibly check. And you just have to, and that's why anymore I'm like, I don't care, you can check whatever record you want on me. I've already been
thoroughly
scanned.
Yep.
There's nothing you can scan that hasn't been scanned on me. So.
Click on it.
There we go. Okay, everybody, we are back. I had to pause in case you didn't notice. I may not edit this a whole lot, but there was something I said that I had to pause and address and ask for forgiveness. I want to rewind to the point back a little bit verbally. A lot of people, there's a learning curve to adoption, and maybe Christina, you can explain the mindset and verbiage and my faux pas.
Sure. And this is something that we picked up on in our classes at the adoption agency too, or reading other people's blogs as they went through their process, because that was like our light at the end of the tunnel, was to read other people's experiences. And none of them are the same.
Mm-hmm.
And mine is not the same as anybody else's. But you so innocently said settled on adoption, which I so appreciate that, because you didn't say settled for. And I said, look, we didn't settle for anything, and I understand that's not what you meant. And there are things that people said in complete innocence that just hurt my heart. And it's just because they've just never been through the process, and they don't understand when you say things sometimes, you're actually not helping. As much as you want to help and you want to be encouraging, it's not helpful. Some of those things were, you know, this process took a whole lot longer than what they told us in the beginning. And so people had doubts, and they would say, are you sure that they're not just trafficking children? And that would hurt me so bad, because Paul and I, we're going to these monthly meetings.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing everything we're asked to do. It all feels legitimate. I mean, we're talking about bringing children from a different family and a different country and a different culture across the border into our family with a completely different culture, completely different language. And so I understand that people would begin to think, you know, maybe they're just taking your money and running, but that wasn't the case. people didn't know that, but we're at these meetings and we see family after family after family from multiple countries coming through with their children, and they have the same process. You know, their stories are all different, but you know, once we got this paperwork in, and then with this week we were here and this week we were there, it's all lining up. People on the outside don't see that, and they don't understand how hurtful that is to suggest that, because we've put years of work into this.
You were living and breathing that.
Yeah, and it was our hope. It was the focus of our life. There's people who said, I don't remember, somebody said something at work one time, and it pretty much just shut it down for me. I was like, I went in and told my boss, look, somebody said this, it's not appropriate, it's hurtful, and I'm done talking about this adoption. So I want you to know, I'm done. People would say, so hopefully, you know, well, we're still praying you have your own kids. And that, to
me, as if the adopted kids wouldn't be good enough.
Exactly.
Or,
and not only that, but I'm the problem. It's my physical, it's the way I was made that's prohibiting that. And this is how things are. And I'm doing everything I can to bring children into this family. I feel called to be a mom. I really want to be a mom. And that's still not good enough for you. You're still going to pray for something else. And I know they didn't mean that. And it took me years to figure out how to express that.
The guilt, I can imagine the guilt that you felt. Not nothing you could do to control that either.
Well, sometimes you just have to realize people's innocent ignorance, and you just have to walk away from
that's
it. Because some people you can't correct them. You just, you know, some people you can educate through the process, and sometimes it's like you just have to walk away. And that's all part of going through the whole process, is getting a thick skin, and the whole education process of, you're going to hear people, oh, well, you couldn't have children of your own, you know, those kind of, and it's like, no, these children will be my own. I promise you that. So, you know, you just have to be careful, because I'm, you know, in the process, I'm not looking to beat people with it's just, but you have to understand, they just don't understand. They didn't have the same, go through the same process, the emotional roller coaster, everything we did to go through this process to get where we were. So, and on that same note, I wanted to rewind a little bit too, and talk a little bit about some of my spiritual experiences of, that got me to the point of being able to be ready to adopt. Because we weren't ready at the same time. So we were going through these emotional roller coasters with the fertility treatments and things like that. And we had started talking about, okay, well, adoption's probably going to be the way we might have to go, you know, those kind of things. And yeah, I kind of had assumed when we were talking about adoption, you know, early on in our marriage, or even before, that okay, adoption might be after we had biological children, and yeah, we might go and see what that's about. Not that, oh hey, this is going to be what we're going to do right away, you know. And so, you know, that's like a complete mind change, you know, path change.
And for me, you weren't expecting it to become the reality. So
well, yeah, it was just a, you know, am I ready to go on that path, you know? And it was a, am I ready to give up on this, am I, you know, on the fertility stuff. And I was struggling, you know, of making that switch. And as
from the spiritual end of things too, how hard was it to say, you know, do we trust God a little bit longer?
Yeah.
Because everything's in His time. So how long do we wait before we decide, you know?
Well, and I was, you know, it got to the point where I was just emotionally drained, done. It's one of those times where you're just like, I've got nothing left but to give it to You, Lord. You know, that's where you're at.
Yeah.
We're, you know, we're Christians. We, you know, and so we believe in Christ and the love of Jesus Christ, and that He's with us and alive, and He gives us guidance and direction, those kind of things. And on the way home from work one day, I was just pouring my heart out to God in my truck on 435 at rush hour traffic. I'm sitting there. I've got nothing else to think about other than this, you know, gigantic, you know, pressure and strain and stress that was just, it was difficult. And so I was just, Lord, I don't know what to do. I need guidance and direction. I need you, you know. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, when I said that, the Lord put an image in my mind. And it was a complete black background, just like in space. Mm-hmm. And the earth came into picture in my mind, and a hand pointed to the earth. And I could see a hand with just the index finger pointing to the earth. And and he said to my mind, I have a child for you. And in that moment, I knew exactly what he was telling me, was that adoption was the path we were going to be on. And all the strain, all the stress, all the mental turmoil, all of the fertility treatments, all of that just melted away into pure happiness for me. And that, okay, the Lord gave me the direction I needed to know, okay, this is the path we're going to go. Mm-hmm. And what an awesome experience that was for me to be able to relieve that, to walk home and tell Christina, you know, oh, I'm on board, you know, well, let's do this.
Where were you at that point? Were you relieved then when he said that? Did you feel the same peace, or were there still some questions? And
I was already on the path. Mm-hmm. I mean, I already was like, well, okay, this is just the next step. Mm-hmm.
She was on the she was already researching.
Yeah. I was ready to apply. I was ready to pick a place. And that's, I think, awesome.
I had
already applied to the agency, I think, even at that point.
I was already going down the path, but I mentally wasn't there.
Right.
And so I was trying to catch up, you know, and that's when I broke through the gate. The Lord allowed me to see that path was okay, you know, and to understand, you know, just to understand that gave me a gigantic
relief. What a gift that was.
And saying that, it reminds me of my favorite scripture in Psalms, where it says, and actually it starts out saying, be still, and then it goes on to say, and know that I am. But I always stick with the first two words, be still, because what you two went through was turmoil, chaos, confusion, heartache, heartbreak. You were forgetting about the part that God said, if you two would just be quiet, I have something for you. And it took you a long time to remember that verse, and some powerful force said, Paul, just be still.
There's a Stephen Curtis Chapman song that goes right along with that, and it's called Be Still and Know That I Am God. Mm-hmm. And whenever Abby and I sing that sometimes for church, and it's one of those, it breaks me up, because it brings that testimony right to the forefront of, you know, the best time to listen to God is when you're still in your quiet places.
It's basically a call to work. Yeah. So, hey, if you would just shut up for a minute, looky what I...
How many times has that been our calling within the last 90 days or so?
Stop talking at me and listen.
Yes. I'm giving you the answers if you would just quit trying to figure it all out.
Close the mouth hole for a minute.
Yep.
But it's a deeper meaning than that. It's not a be quiet, quit talking. It's your whole body, your whole spirit.
Yeah.
It's literally stay in one spot. Don't move. Don't do anything. Because in a crowd, you hear the crowd. You don't hear one voice unless it's right here. You literally have to learn to just close down shop.
To me, I liken it to the old days of tuning the radio, you know, getting rid of the static, you know. You turn the dial and you get till the static goes away, and that's what you have. That's where the relationship part of being with Christ is getting rid of the static. You got to tune in, and that's part of having the relationship with them, that a difficult part is you gotta dial that in, you know, because he's there, he wants to talk to you, he wants to give you that information, but he wants you to kind of work for it a little bit and to find him. And by doing that, you gotta turn the knob. Otherwise, all you're gonna hear is static.
You gotta point that satellite dish.
You gotta
do everywhere.
It's important.
Okay, so you guys walked down the path. You did everything you could do. You were accepted. At what moment did it become reality? Like, okay, this is where we're at. And then airport time.
It took a long time.
There's a lot that happened between those two things.
We started the process in 2004. We didn't travel until 2009.
Wow.
So
it was 2005 when we started, because that's your interest.
Well,
point,
I was talking about when we started conversations.
Adoption,
I mean, our whole process started really in 2004.
Wow.
So, you know, we went through the start of the process of getting child, trying to get one child, and under 2 years, and we waited on that list for a long time.
Over 3 years.
Yeah, 3 years, and there were still people in front of us. There was no movement, and it was getting to the point where the process was starting to feel very burdensome. You know, another Christmas, we already had the nursery set up, you know, we had we had the crib, we had all those things in there, and it was gathering dust.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to the point where another Christmas went by, you know, and it was difficult because we thought by that point we were already going to have a child in our home, and here we are, we're, you know, 3 years into this, another Christmas has gone by where family's like, where is this child, you know? All you have to answer all those questions again another year.
Well, and that's really the year that people started asking. You know, they had been patient, and so I want to give them credit for that. They had been waiting with us. But yeah, by that third Christmas, they were starting to ask questions, and it was hard to push through that Christmas for multiple reasons. So many things happened.
Well, and we had to come to reality too. We started having some conversations of, okay, we get this one child, is that good enough? Or are we planning on going back through this process again? You know, you start thinking about those when we go to these monthly meetings and we see these people going through these meetings and coming home with 2, 3, 4, 5 children at a time, and it really, the wheels start turning of, do we jump lists and go to another list? What do we do? Can we handle that? I mean, that's a whole complete mentality change of when you're starting to change lists like that.
That's part of God being patient with us and putting us in the in His time, and us trying to tune into Him is, you just rarely saw in Colombia one child come home. I mean, through the whole process of 4 or 5 years of waiting, we saw like 3 or 4 families come home with one child. Everybody else had 3 or more kids.
Mm-hmm.
So we had seen literally dozens of families come home with 3 kids, 3 to like 6 kids at once. And they were doing it. They were making it work.
We were building relationships with them too, and
meeting
these children going, okay, well, maybe this is possible, you know? Before, you're like, are you crazy getting 3
kids?
Yeah,
that's a big leap of faith.
Well, and then they also, they sent out that particular program. Colombia allowed them to send out a tiny bit of information about kids who were on what they call their waiting list. So these are sibling groups. We're always on the waiting list, the waiting children. It could be this child had TB, or this child lost a finger, or they're born with an extra finger, and they weren't put on that healthy kids list. These kids were mostly perfectly healthy. There are a few who they already knew maybe had learning disabilities or something, but they wanted those kids to have families. And so that country allowed the agency to forward a just like two sentences. age. Sometimes you got their name, sometimes you didn't. Sometimes you got their picture, sometimes you didn't. So month after month, we're seeing these kids that are like mostly healthy, but their sibling groups come through. And, you know, if the oldest one is 10 and here we are 27, 28, that's kind of close in age to us.
Yeah.
So, but we knew that was an option. Mm-hmm. And there's kids that got, you saw those families that took those waiting kids because they'd be in the next month's issue with their kids.
That's right.
Yeah. All right, so you guys are on the plane. What was the excitement level?
Well, what's
stress?
How about the announcement first? At what point?
Well, we'll talk to you through about how we switched lists and all that. So we made the determination, all right, we're going to switch lists. So that included we had to update our home study. Mm-hmm. We had to make it where we had to actually resubmit it because of how you have to be approved to be able, can you handle three children? Do you understand what that entails? Wow. I mean, so it took probably 2 or 3 months for us to revise our home study. Mm-hmm. So we went through that process and updated it and submitted it to the country, and we were approved very quickly.
I think we submitted it in April, and we were approved by July for multiple children.
And then we waited by July. December, we were selected for three children. We had submitted for three children. Is what we had asked for.
With one being a baby, which meant 2 years and younger.
Yeah, we asked if one of the three could be under 2 years. Mm-hmm. The other two, we had asked that you can kind of give a ballpark. And
right.
And try, you know, you never know, but I think we said under eight. We would prefer all of them be under 8 years old if possible. Mm-hmm. But other than that, under eight, and then one of them being under two if possible. Mm-hmm. So, and then we got selected in that December. And so we got a picture of the three healthy little pretty young ladies.
Mm-hmm. Ages 2, 4, and 6.
2, 4, and 6 awesome. Years old. And and then we're off and running. So that happened in December. And then we traveled in January.
Mm-hmm. So that happened quickly after you made that decision.
Once you get that selection.
Yeah.
Did that kind of bump you to the front of the bus, so to speak? Like the
sibling lists go, I mean, it's like the fast lane.
Mm-hmm. On this end, I want to say in Colombia, they do as thorough of a job to get those children in with Colombian families as they can. Colombian families always get selected first. They always do, and you know that going in. Mm-hmm. Look, if the economy's up in Colombia, there's going to be more adopted families, mm-hmm. and you're going to get bumped down that list, and that happened.
Mm-hmm. That's what happened to the baby list, was their economy went up, and so the babies, instead of going through their abandonment process and getting adopted internationally, they ended up staying within the country because they were staying with the family, and that's great. Mm-hmm. I think
that's
optimal.
Attractive to us.
And that's why we're like, we can't really gripe because those children are where they need to
be. That's right.
So the abandonment process in Colombia is very extensive. It takes a year for them to go through the
third. I think it's 6 months.
Well, they have to be like publicized on a television station for so long so that extended family can come try to claim. I mean, they go through.
Social services gets involved and you get the report on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do psychological evaluations. It's a very extensive.
So you know their background ahead of time as much as possible.
Yeah, we got a lot of paperwork on the kids that had like psychological evaluations for each child and things, you know, just personality things that was, it was cool to see. And it was amazing how accurate a lot of that paperwork was too. I was kind of surprised. It was, you know, it changes over time, of course, but it was nice to at least have a ballpark of kind of their personalities a little bit before we went down there. So
what did it feel like when you're finally on that plane and you were ready to go? Were you excited? Were you terrified?
Both.
What were your thoughts?
So when did reality set in? Like, okay, It's go time.
For me, it was when we got the pictures, you know? Yeah. You see those little faces, your life changes, you know? And it's amazing, you know? And it was so funny. It was like, three girls? What?
Yeah.
You know, you're like, three children. Surely there's got to be a boy in there, right? No. That's okay.
You got three girls.
Right. Three wonderful, healthy baby, not baby, but little girls. So, yeah. And amazing. So.
And now you're on the plane, you're in the air, you land. Do you feel like at some point, like time wasn't moving fast enough? Did you want to wish you could fast forward through time and just grab and take them back? What was it like down there? How long did it take before you could actually see them, and then so forth and so on?
Well, for me, when we landed, that's when it felt like nobody was holding our hand anymore in this process. Because we weren't, you know, then we actually, I mean, it was literally foot to pavement. We had to work our way through the airport. Somebody didn't meet us there. Mm-hmm. It was nighttime. It was dark. You go through customs on your own. That was scary to me. But there, you know, you just hope your taxi cab driver takes you to the place you're supposed to go, because they're not waiting for you. Mm-hmm. And all of that lined up. And yes, the bed and breakfast was waiting for us. And we had to stay one night in the capital city.
Bogota.
Yep. And yeah, by that time I was like, let's just go get these kids. I just want to see these kids. I'm here. I'm not going to sleep tonight. Well, let's just go.
Yeah.
But the next day we had to fly into their city, which was fantastic. Mm-hmm. That was amazing.
Yeah,
amazing.
We went to...
Don't say the name.
Oh, I want it. But we flew into the city and it was like paradise.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's in the Andes Mountains and it's... You got
tropical.
It's tropical. You see tropical birds. You see pineapples and bananas and I mean all the stuff that are just growing, all, you know.
Oh yeah.
And trucks driving by full of bananas or whatever.
Wow.
And fresh fruit stands, you know, and you walk in this beautiful bed and breakfast we got to stay in, and it was amazing.
Well, it was January when we traveled.
Yeah.
We're in the Midwest. It is dead out here in
Midwest.
Nice. Oh yeah.
And we go to Colombia and there's like just tropical foliage, everything's green, it's warm, we're driving with the windows
like you
down.
Said paradise.
Yeah. Surrounded by green mountains and these, I mean it was picturesque.
Oh, yeah.
To say the
beautiful
least.
When adoption became what it was, cost obviously shifted now. Was going down to Colombia, was that an expense all on its own? You guys were down there, what, a month, right?
We were down there about 4 weeks.
So that had to have been whole other level of cost.
Well, once we knew we were going down the adoption process, we had, you know, 5 years where we were doing fundraiser dinners. We were doing everything we could. We had several fundraisers. We were making Christmas wreaths. We were selling anything we possibly could. Spaghetti dinners. We were doing all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
People were very generous with us and helping us raise money, which we had to do because, you know, you're flying to another country. You're having to stay in a bed and breakfast for basically 4 weeks, you know.
And was that a requirement that you had to stay there for that long before you came home? Okay.
Yeah, because you have to go through all the court systems, all the legalities of them becoming legally yours.
Mm-hmm. You have to go through the adoption process down there.
In
so that takes
time. So, yeah, I had to physically go to each one of the cities that they were born in and go to the registrar's office, and they had to like change all their paperwork to our names down in Colombia before we could even travel back to Bogota.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was legal all the way down to their birth certificates in Colombia. So,
was that part nerve-wracking too, worrying about, you know, if one thing slips by, then maybe this won't happen?
It's a long process, but you know, our adoption agency walked us through it so well.
They
had great staff down there that they helped walk us through. The lawyers we had were fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
We had translators that they lined up for us that would help us down in the country. the bed and breakfast knew why we were there. They specialized in helping adoptive families.
Oh, they did.
So they surrounded us with people that were our support.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so fantastic.
Mm-hmm. It had to be a game changer. You didn't feel so alone then.
Right. Yeah. Well, because all the families at the bed and breakfast are going through the same thing.
True.
And those families, I know there was a German family there, and they got two
Italian.
Children. Was there some Italians?
Mm-hmm.
Some people from Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody's like on the same page. We're all going, this is all our first day together.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
We all just got these kids.
Crew.
We don't know what we're doing. Nobody's judging you.
We'll figure it out together. Yeah.
It was really cool to see other perspectives from other people. We got to know the people from Germany pretty well while we were there.
Yeah.
And just to talk to them about their process. I mean, they were using a different agency, but we all just kind of happened to be there at the same time.
Yeah.
And it was awesome while we were there. They treated us so kindly. The people there were wonderful. You know, you hear about Colombia and you think the worst, you know, but at the time when we were down there, Colombia was very peaceful. We had no safety problems. It was glorious. We traveled all over
every
the place.
We
took the kids to a lot of the highlight places around town.
Mm-hmm.
Our bed and breakfast had their own driver that she let us use, and we paid for his time. But he would take us to parks and, you know, a lot of beautiful places where we could take the kids and things like that. So that in-country was some of the best memories for me of allowing us to some bonding time just together with just without outside interference.
Before we take you out of your element.
Yeah, you know, before you're inrushed with all these family that want to meet you, you have this opportunity to just be with your children.
Was there ever a point when you guys were down there where we were ever in a position like safety might have been a factor, like, or worse yet, was there ever a point when you ever worry about, hey, what if we get down there and something changes, or were you locked in, this is what we're going for, you know what I'm saying? Was there
I think for me, I trusted the process. I mean, we've seen it so many times with so many other families. We had really good people around us, like I said, so I didn't, you know, something could always happen, but I mean, we trusted the process.
Mm-hmm.
It was very well organized.
Yeah, I was gonna say,
it didn't leave a lot
established.
You know, and two, as soon as we got in the country or the city where the children were, it was, let's see, we flew in that morning, dropped our stuff off.
Went to lunch with the owner of the bed and breakfast.
That's right,
And she asked us, so I'd learned a little bit of Spanish in high school and college. The owner of the bed and breakfast, she was learning English. So we were about the same level with each other's language. And she was asking us, well, where are your children? You know, do you know where they're coming from, which organization or whatever? And so we told her, and she said, oh, well, I volunteer there.
That's awesome.
She's super familiar with the place, familiar with the children. They're really good to the kids there, and you know, they've been really well taken care of. I know they have.
Yeah,
so that was really cool.
So by the next day we get up and we go, and we have the children by that next, I mean, so we don't have a lot of time to think about things. It's
right.
We walk into
probably
a room.
Probably a good thing.
It is. And there's a lot of weight. I mean, you go, you travel, you go, go to a room, and all of a sudden they come busting through the door. You know, these beautiful kids, and they, you could tell they were well prepared before they got to us, you know.
That's awesome.
They walked in and they were like, Mommy, Daddy, you know, things like that, which is...
I mean, maybe one of them was like
I mean, they had the petrified look, but you could tell they were prepared by the people of, go in there, you know.
Yep.
And they were doing their best to play the part.
They were.
Mm-hmm. They were trying to be brave. They were trying so hard.
They were dressed up in these beautiful, brand new dresses, and their hair was all done pristinely.
They spent hours on them.
You know, and it was wonderful. It was a great first meeting, and we took them back to our bread and breakfast, and that's when we had a couple weeks of just getting to know them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was awesome.
So you mentioned they were the door opened and in walked three beautiful angels. Were you told, so let's flip it a minute, what was it like on their side? What was their prep like?
Okay, everybody, this concludes the first of two installments. Please check out the second one. Thanks.